Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sorts of jobs are immigrant laborers filling in the U.S. economy? Are they taking jobs that rightly belong to U.S. citizens? Journalist Gabriel Thompson got curious about those questions after he read a 2007 New York Times article about a North Carolina hog butchering operation that struggled to find workers after an immigration raid on the plant. So he set out on a year-long odyssey that consisted of applying for and working at low-wage jobs that are typically held by recent immigrants, from picking lettuce in Arizona to delivering takeout by bicycle in New York City. He chronicles his experiences and the lessons they taught him in a new book called Working in the Shadows, a year of doing the jobs most Americans won't do. Gabriel, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You've done a lot of writing in the past on immigration. Before you had the sort of aha moment to take on this project, did you think you had a pretty good working knowledge of the experiences of immigrant laborers?
You know, I at least knew that some of the people I had written about, primarily in New York City, because that's where I'm living, had either worked in places like poultry plants or who had relatives that had worked done farm work. So, and I had also done some reporting about people. I'd been successful in kind of sneaking onto sweatshop floors in Brooklyn and getting to know some people who generally would be invisible, but just through snooping around, you know, finding people that were making $1, $2 an hour in sweatshops. So I had some idea that there was a lot of really hard work going on and low wages, but it was all sort of secondhand. It was through interviews with people. It was through watching them work, but not, this was a different experience to actually take on those jobs myself.
Yeah, and you made some decisions at the outset about how you were going to go about this, including not revealing to anybody, including the people you were working alongside, that you were, in fact, a journalist. Will you talk about why you wanted to keep that a secret?
Well, it was mostly a matter of, I guess, trying to keep a hold of who knows things. So, you know, there were a lot of people I met that became friends on jobs, and I wanted to eventually tell them, you know, like midway through a job, I'm actually writing a book, but I was afraid that word could spread and eventually a worker could tell another worker, and then that worker could tell someone who's close to a supervisor, and then once a supervisor knows, the supervisor tells the head of the company, and pretty soon they're telling me, you know, it's great you're here for a little while, but your services are no longer needed. So it was mostly wanting to protect myself. You know, I was moving around different places around the country, and that's kind of expensive, and trying to set up shop and trying to get a job. And so my goal was to stay with each job for 2 months. if I started telling people, and the way I thought of it is, you know, it's a strange experience to do something completely in secret, at least for me, and not, you know, come to a new place and not know anyone and spend 2 months there and still no one really knows what you're doing. But I figured, you know, if I told one person, it'd be very easy to then tell some other people, and pretty soon, you know, I think it's human nature to want to share what we're doing, but I tried to clamp down on that.
Yeah, and in fact, you hadn't told anyone, but you were found out at the chicken plant job you had. But then when they fired you, it was kind of a surreal experience. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was, first I should say, it was from my own stupidity. I mean, it's not that they were incredibly good investigators at the plant, but what I wanted to do, so I spent time at a slaughterhouse, and that's where you deal with the chickens when they're killed and then sort of disassembled. But I was living in a trailer right next to the plant, and all day, every day, there'd be, trucks would be passing with live chickens being brought. And so I really wanted to get a sense of what it was like, the chicken's life was like, you know, from the time they hatch to when they grow up on the farm and before they're delivered to a slaughterhouse. So I was trying to get a tour of a chicken farm, and I revealed too much information to a farmer. And that farmer was actually contracted to grow for Pilgrim's Pride, the company where I was working at the processing plant. So they realized when the farmer called that I was actually working at the plant and called me in. I was working the graveyard shift, so they called me in around 11:15 p.m. And I actually thought they were going to transfer me to a new department. But then I realized there's like four people in the office. There was a head of HR and sat me down and said that they had been speaking to their lawyers, they'd gone on my website, I had purchased my previous books. One of the people would actually was going to sign up for my newsletter, which is very, you know, it was odd. But at the end of this, they said, you know, you're fired. And I said, okay. You know, I realized once I didn't really put up much of a fight, because once I knew that they knew who I was, it really, you know, even if I was able to stay on the job, it would be a totally different experience. And I realized, I think, too, that I was thinking, you know, you'd think HR, these people firing you, there'd be animosity. But really, I think their job was pretty monotonous as well. You know, they're constantly trying to hire new people, and turnover is incredibly high, and they're doing the same orientations day after day. So this, I think, was a nice little break. It's kind of an odd thing to have someone who's writing about the plant.
Yeah, the other interesting thing about that whole experience, in that they weren't particularly cruel to you, is that you know, these places where workers are laboring under what appear to be pretty abusive conditions are not necessarily run by people who say, we hate the people who work for us and we want to, you know, mess with them. There's just not a lot of concern for their needs.
Yeah, it's the way certain industries are structured. So, you know, for chicken, it's all about getting the cheapest chicken you can, and you have big chicken companies competing with each other to see who can provide the cheapest meat to some place like McDonald's. So that means that in order to control costs, you know, one of the big costs is labor. So they're going to pay as little as possible, and the pace of work is going to be as fast as possible. Now, it's not that supervisors are there yelling at you to go fast. It's just the pace of the work, the line speed of how many chickens are moving past you as you're making a cut to them is incredibly fast. And if you don't keep up, you know, you'll be fired. But the managers at the plant were more like technocrats. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted to make sure everything was going according to plan, and if someone couldn't keep up, they'd get fired. But it wasn't like they were especially mean. It was bigger than just one personality. The whole industry was, the whole plant was sort of oppressively fast, and the work was punishing, but it didn't have that much to do with an individual supervisor.
I was really floored by the number of cuts that you were required to make when you were butchering a chicken in an average shift. I had to read it twice. Now I'm going to ask you to say it out loud. How many cuts do you make in a shift if you're on a chicken butchering line?
Well, it's called a debone line, and it starts out with a chicken coming that's like the carcass, and then you have to, each person does a certain cut along the line. On the debone line, people can make up to like 18,000 cuts in a shift. So it's an identical cut. What I was doing was a little bit different, because I was in a department where we worked with chicken breasts, which are, you know, used in everything from chicken strips to patties to nuggets. And one of my tasks was to stand in place and tear chicken breasts in half. Mm-hmm. And so in a shift, I could tear between 7,000 and 8,000 chicken breasts. So they come, you know, kind of shaped like a heart a little bit, and you grab them with your hands and you tear it down the middle, and you just do that over and over and over again. And as you're doing it, because you're doing it with your hands, it takes some force, you know. Chicken fat is flying places, and there's sort of blood all over the place, and it's, you know, it's not the most pleasant job.
And the breast came to you frozen. How long did it take till your hands were frozen every shift?
Oh, pretty quick. You know, you would try to wear two pairs of these cheap cotton gloves, and then on top of them wear a plastic glove. But often when I was tearing breasts, the breasts would get dumped into a huge sort of bin, and that bin was also filled with ice and sort of chicken juice, blood and whatever. And so often when you're digging deep to get the breasts out of this bin, your hands are, you know, in like a frigid bath. So, and it's also worth mentioning that the temperature in the plant is probably around 40 degrees. Hmm. So it's, coldness is something that you're constantly dealing with.
And what were you making per hour?
I think I was making $8.05 an hour.
Hmm. How did you feel at the end of the day physically?
You know, it was weird. It was, you'd be exhausted. The hands were really the most, the body part that gets the most abuse at a plant, because so much of the work is involved around making an identical motion over and over and over again with your hands. And I mean, even they tell you this in orientation, that you should get used to having a lot of hands and a lot of pain in your hands and wrists because you're using your tendons in ways that you normally don't. And at the plant, actually, there was in the break room, there was a wall sort of that had devoted to just various kinds of painkillers that workers could buy. So at the end of the day, I'd have very sore hands. At one point, I was dumping tubs of chicken, and so those could be about 70 pounds each, and so then your back would be sore. But there was also a huge sense of relief at the end of the day, just that you don't have to be back there for a while, because it was, of all the jobs that I did over the year, it was the one in which I just got the sense that if you did this for a long time, the mental the experiences are so repetitive that it just kind of plays with your mind a little bit.
Yeah, do they have like a radio on, or what are you doing with your mind while you're doing this work that is essentially mindless?
No, the way the plant's structured, it's really loud, so you have to wear earplugs. And so you can't really talk to anyone, and you can't hear anything because, I mean, if you unplugged, you took out the earplugs, it would just be this rush of noise. And so you're too far away to talk to anyone, and you're standing in one place, and it's cold, and you're doing one motion over and over again, looking like, so I was tearing chicken breasts that are coming by in a belt or that are in this tub. And you're just doing that over and over again, and I don't know what happens with your, you know, what you focus on. It's kind of a blur to me because you would zone out a little bit. A lot of times people would fall asleep standing up, which was, I mean, one of my first weeks there, a woman was fired for falling asleep on the job, and I actually watched her, and she would just kind of tuck her chin in and be out for like 45 seconds and not fall down somehow. What I learned after was that she had a young child, and so she would, while she was working at night, she had money to pay for a sitter, but she would come home at around 8 in the morning, and her child would be waking up ready to play, and she didn't have money to pay for to care for her during the day, so she basically would be up with the child during the day and then go to work at night. And so there were a lot of situations like that where people, you just see how hard a lot of people's lives are.
It seems like that would put you at great risk for getting sick all the time, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the coldness, how cold it is, how lack of sleep, you know, working is my first experience really working the night shift. And I did it I was fired after about 5.5 weeks, and I never really got a good night's or a good day's sleep. You know, it's also that it was Alabama. It was the summertime. You're in a trailer that's very, you know, just gets so hot.
Yeah.
That it definitely, you know, what I noticed was a lot of my coworkers that had been doing this for a while just looked very old. Everyone thought I was like just out of high school, simply because, you know, it's not that I look especially young. I think it's just that I haven't been doing this kind of work for a long time.
And what's the average life expectancy for like a farm or an agricultural worker in this country who's an immigrant?
Well, I think they did a study a few years ago that said it was about 49 for farm workers. And that's partly because the work is punishing, but it's also partly a reflection of how segregated and marginalized farm workers are. So they have very poor access to things like good health care and such.
Journalist Gabriel Thompson is my guest. His new book is called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Gabriel Thompson. His new book is called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Gabriel, I want to skip back here and talk about the first job you had, which was in Yuma, Arizona. For those of us who have not spent time there, tell us about the city.
Well, it's one of the hottest places in the country, and its claim to fame, as I learned when I started doing research on where I wanted to go for my first job, is that it's right near the U.S.-Mexico border. It's kind of in the, southwest corner of Arizona, so it's right up against California as well. And most of the year, almost all the lettuce we eat comes from Salinas, but in the winter, Salinas, California. But in the winter, California gets a little too cold, so for I think it's like 4.5 months, almost all the lettuce that is consumed in the U.S. and Canada actually comes from Yuma. So I remember I was speaking to a professor of agriculture at Yuma, and he was saying that there are about 12 million heads of lettuce harvested a day in Yuma and during the winter season. And even in February, you know, I think one day in February, the high got to 90 degrees. So it's an incredibly warm place. I mean, one nice thing about this book, one pleasant thing among many things that weren't quite as pleasant was being able to avoid a New York City winter and spend it in Yuma.
What was fascinating there was that although it was not hard at all for you to get a job, it was hard for you to get the job that you said you wanted.
Yeah, I went in and I expected, you know, some skepticism and, you know, I showed up in Yuma, I hadn't really been there before, and I would drive around around the fields and see that, you know, everyone I saw working looked Latino and almost all Mexican. And so when I went, I got a job at Dole, and I chose Dole just because actually when I checked into a motel and someone said, oh, you should check out Dole, and it's big, so I figured why not. And the first person I spoke to, you know, was incredulous, like, why, are you sure you really want to do this? And they tried to offer me a job. First one was inside doing some sort of packing job. When I came again, they wondered if I wanted to be they had an opening for a bilingual forklift driver. So, I was concerned that they might think I was, I don't know, like a union organizer or doing something undercover, which I was. You know, I was a journalist, but their main concern was every year, I guess, a couple people would come in looking for work that were Anglo, that looked like me. And they generally didn't last very long. And so it was sort of a pain from their perspective to put someone out in a crew, get them trained, get the equipment, and then have to replace that person really quickly.
What kind of union protection is available for agricultural workers?
Well, where I was, you know, almost no farm workers have unions. I was in a really, a different situation because it turns out that in Yuma, Dole workers were actually represented by the Teamsters. Now, I didn't see much of a difference in terms of our pay was $8.27 an hour, I think, so our pay actually wasn't that much better. But what I did find in Yuma versus, I think, if I had, you know, done a job like picking tobacco in North Carolina, for example, or picking tomatoes in Florida, was that because Yuma is right against the Mexican border and there's a lot of history of moving back and forth, a lot of the farm workers that would come from Mexico had a sense of, you know, that there are certain protections and certain labor protections, minimum wages and rights they had that you wouldn't necessarily, I think farm workers might not know as much about their rights when, you know, they're recruited in Guatemala to go work in Maine, for example, and they show up in the middle of nowhere and don't really know anyone.
There were a lot of times when you would have to wait while you were cutting lettuce to start work and you weren't compensated for that time.
Yeah. I mean, there was two kind of big complaints, I would say, that people had. One is on cool mornings, we would show up and the lettuce would have frost on it, so we'd have to wait around for the sun to melt the frost, because I guess when you cut it, if it has frost on it, it can somehow damage the lettuce. But another bigger complaint was a lot of times we'd be working quite a ways outside of Yuma. And for the coworkers that were coming from Mexico, and they were all guest workers, basically what people had argued, the companies, had argued to get these guest worker slots was that there weren't local U.S. citizens who could fill the labor demand there in Yuma. So they would come from the border and sometimes, you know, spend 2.5 hours one way to get to the fields, then 2.5 hours back. And none of that travel time was compensated either.
What does it take to cut a head of lettuce? How do you get it from the field to that little shrink-wrapped ball that we find in the grocery store?
Yeah, I mean, I when I came into lettuce, I knew it was going to be hard. I didn't know how much skill went into the job. So first, it's a misnomer to pick lettuce because no one picks lettuce. You cut lettuce, so you have maybe an 18-inch knife, and you're walking in the field, and you've got rows on your left and right. You bend down, you make a first kind of stabbing motion that separates the lettuce from the ground, so it goes through the trunk, and you kind of stand up or stooped over, and you have to trim it again at the trunk to cut it more closely, and that allows a lot of the outside leaves to fall off. While you're doing that, about a fifth of the heads, that may be a little high, would not be usable. So they might have been, it might be look unappetizing, they might be too small or too big or have sun damage. So while you're trimming them and cleaning off the outer leaves, you're also making sure that it's a good one. And then you have bags hanging from your belt, and you sort of, in this one quick motion, bag each head of lettuce and put it on this extension on this lettuce harvesting machine that you're following. From there, the lettuce gets the bags. Heads of lettuce go into boxes. The boxes go onto pallets. The pallets are eventually moved onto a truck. The truck leaves the field and goes right to the cooling plant. That's where the plant cools the lettuce very quickly, and it's then put on a trailer where it also stays cool. And I think it was like from Arizona to New York City, it would be like a head of lettuce cut on Monday would be in New York City on Wednesday or Thursday.
And how old were you when you did this in, I guess, last year?
I was 08, so I was 30.
Okay. And you say this was like the proudest physical achievement of your life, sticking with this work for 2 months.
Yeah, it was, it's obviously I didn't go into cutting lettuce thinking, oh, this is going to be an easy job. And in fact, I was glad that it was my first job, I think, because I thought it was going to be the most physically tiring. And it certainly was. You know, I would be sweating constantly. My hands would be sore. My back would be aching. But then all these other things I hadn't thought about, like my feet. You're walking in these little furrows, like in between the rows, and the ground is always uneven. And your feet would just get swollen and tired. And it was I don't think I realized how beaten up my body was until I actually stopped, because it was a good number of weeks before I would feel comfortable shaking someone's hand because my hands were so sore, and my right foot was numb for about a month after. I don't know exactly, I never went to a doctor or anything, but there's just all this stress that's put on your body, and I would be asleep every night without exception around 8 p.m., no energy to do anything.
You were given at the places you worked some safety training. Did you, in fact, get the impression that the companies were at least interested in the safety of their employees?
I did in lettuce, and less so in the poultry plant. The lettuce fields every morning, our foreman would talk about any special dangers in the field and point out certain things we should be looking for. In poultry, it's just the way it's structured. There's just nothing you can really do if you're going to be making someone, for example, tear 8,000 chicken breasts in half, that's going to do damage eventually to your hands and wrists. So I'm sure they're concerned that I don't, slip and fall and break my back or something. But in terms of preventing damage in the hands, it's very difficult to do just because of the nature of the work. In New York City, I shifted from working at these huge companies to my first job I did very briefly was in Manhattan, has this area called the Flower District, which is where they have all these wholesale flower shops. And there I worked for a mom and pop shop. I thought would be really cool as a sort of change of pace, and I thought flowers would be nice. And what I found there was exactly the opposite. There you had sort of, I would say, almost malicious bosses who were very abusive and kind of ran it as their own little kingdom, the shop, and they exhibited very little interest in my or other employees' safety.
It was really poignant there, and you ultimately got fired there after just a couple of days because you couldn't sort of do what they wanted you to do. But one of the other employees said to you early on, what are you doing here? You have papers. You could work anywhere. I would quit in a heartbeat if I could.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I had seen a little bit of this reporting about immigration and immigrants' experiences in New York City, but sometimes you have the worst, the most unhealthy sort of work environment psychologically and physically and mentally in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect it. So in little shops where the boss can have an inordinate amount of power over employees and where employees feel like, you know, they're kind of stuck there because, you know, the wages are okay, and if they just can put up with working conditions that no one else would want to put up with, they'll sort of tough it out. And what was really striking to me about that, you know, I was coming from a chicken plant, and I was feeling very proud of myself for having, I mean, it was only 5.5 weeks, and I should just say in general that what I did was a very short experiment, and there are people, there's nothing, you know, people have been doing this for years and are doing it now, so it's pretty unimpressive in the grand scheme of things, but in my head I was, you know, I just did chicken, now how could a flower shop be difficult? But it's a really tough experience to spend a whole day being yelled at and trying to follow directions as best as possible, but still being criticized and not being able to yell something back.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email to think@kera.org from Greg in Dallas, who says, one reason there is no labor at packing plants is because they locate them in rural areas with no population. Clearly, these businesses intend to draw illegal workers. Second, the reason farm jobs are so bad is that an enormous supply of illegal labor gives employers no incentive to innovate and mechanize their production. Why would they want to invest in technology and machinery when it's so much cheaper to exploit illegal labor? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's good points in both. The poultry plant that I worked at was in a town called Russellville, Alabama. And I don't think they located it there because they were looking for immigrants. They located it there because it's in the South in general is the center of poultry because, I mean, it's a very poor region. And these areas will fight tooth and nail to get, you know, make huge concessions to companies that are profitable to have them relocate. So it's true. I mean, there isn't a history of unionization, and so they look at that. Companies are, just as workers coming from the South will come up to find better opportunities, companies are always looking to find ways that they can pay their workforce the lowest amount possible. When I looked through the archives of the newspapers in Russellville announcing the opening of the plant, what was really interesting to me was no one anticipated that there would be a large influx of immigrants from Guatemala and Mexico coming to the town. And it's a very conservative area. It's in where I was in Alabama. It's, you know, it's a dry county, so you don't serve alcohol, which I was quite disappointed upon learning when I got there. And it's the summertime in Alabama, and there's no beer at the grocery stores. And they were just sort of blindsided. You know, there was huge unemployment. Chicken plant's going to provide all these jobs, and what they learned is. A lot of the workers would do it for a little bit and then sour on the experience. And so you had immigrants coming. A lot of people that were working in the tomato fields in Florida would cross the border to Alabama and come work there. And so that was a huge learning. It's an ongoing issue that this town and towns like it across the South are dealing with, is how do you deal with all these new people that look different and speak a different language?
And Russellville was an interesting choice in that regard because they have some significant KKK activity there.
Well, that's what was weird. I mean, that's why it was on my radar a little bit, because I had come across an article about there was a KKK march in 2006 through downtown that attracted a couple hundred people. And I think it, you know, like most of the KKK marches, it's a lot of just people that are curious, but there did seem to be a decent number of supporters. So and that was in reaction to just this growing presence of the immigrant community in town. So I went down to Russellville not only interested in writing about poultry plant work, but and writing about the lives of the people I'd find working there, but about how the town was changing. And I expected to find a lot of animosity. you know, one of the only articles I'd read about race relations had this KKK march. What I discovered, though, was that there was a lot less anger towards immigrants than I had anticipated. I think part of that reason is, you know, you hear immigrants are taking jobs from Americans, and that can fuel a lot of anger. I just didn't find that in Russellville. I showed up, and within a week, you know, with a New York driver's license, I was working at the plant. The problem wasn't getting the jobs. The problem had never been getting the job. The problem was surviving the job and enduring the job. And on the plant floor, I actually found a lot of sort of decent or better than I expected relationships between immigrants and the longtime residents of Russellville.
It almost sounds like there would be a sort of hazing effect where people are brought together by the fact that what they're enduring collectively is so difficult.
Yeah, there was definitely a sort of unifying, I guess, annoyance or anger at supervisors and at the job in some ways, and that brought people together. And then it's just that, you know, there just wasn't very many other avenues for communication. So you might see, you know, the other person, whether immigrant or citizen, like at Walmart or something, but you're not going to be speaking to them. But then you get on the plant floor and suddenly you're spending 8 or 9 hours a day next to someone. And at least, you know, you'll start sharing, you know, curse words or just share some snack or talk a little bit. And that really served as a way to break down some of the initial barriers, I think.
Journalist Gabriel Thompson is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes now available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Gabriel Thompson. His new book is called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. You did form some bonds with your coworkers, particularly in Yuma. What did it take for them to trust that you were not out to somehow do them harm?
I think more than anything, it was just showing up day after day. You know, people were surprised that I stuck with it. Came actually the second day I came back, people were like, "Wow, you returned!" You know, so that was that made me realize what low expectations they had for me. But it's also just the nature of the way it was structured. You work on a crew, and you're with the same crew the whole season. So the 30 other people in my crew are all there, and you get to know each other. You're having your breaks and lunch together. And then there's just the obvious fact that I was completely different than them and different than most of the people in the fields. And so they would have all sorts of random sort of American pop culture questions to ask me, and I would ask them things about where they were living and from. And so it became kind of like I was a conduit in some ways to the general American public, I guess, or English-speaking public. So, yeah, I was really lucky to have been welcomed so much in Lettuce, not only just because it made me feel like I was with friends, but also they really came together to help me out when I was faltering and floundering and learning how to cut lettuce. And I don't think I would have stuck with it very long if I didn't have that you know, folks would reach across the rows and help me out and often so I could keep up with everyone else.
Gabriel, what kind of reform to current immigration policy makes sense to you?
Well, I mean, after the year, I would say my main purpose in writing the book was to talk about describing what this work is like. You know, a lot of people have their policy ideas, but I do at the end sort of what it led me to think, which is that there were a lot of industries like poultry, for example, or even the restaurant worker, that you have undocumented immigrants and U.S. citizens working side by side. And these industries are going to need to be cleaned up. And it'll be very difficult to increase wages and standards if a large percentage of the workers are afraid to assert their rights. So I think, you know, we definitely, and I wouldn't want to, but can't deport undocumented immigrants en masse, but we can move them out of the shadows en masse through legalization process. So I definitely am in favor of mass immigration reform.
We all have to eat, and even if we choose not to eat meat, we have to consume produce, and most of us are not in a position to grow it for ourselves. What would it cost on the consumer level to at least, if you can't eliminate the work or change the nature of the work, compensate people at what appears to be closer to a living wage?
You know, I think what's interesting is, and I don't have the exact figures, but looking at like lettuce, for example, and produce, the average American spends a pretty small amount on produce over the course of a year. And so a professor, I believe, at UC Davis in California had looked at how much you would have to increase the cost of a head of lettuce. And it was small to industry-wide to increase farm workers' wages by, I believe, a couple of dollars an hour, which is a huge difference. And it was, you know, I can't remember the figures, but it was actually not that much money that it would cost the average consumer. But it's not something that you can do on a individual basis. You can't walk into a supermarket and say, okay, where's the lettuce that's where the farm workers have been paid a living wage, because it just doesn't exist. I think you're going to need, you know, you need social movements, you need mass movements that would change these sorts of things. Poultry, again, is very tough because, like I said, the whole system right now, so much of what we and it's not just agriculture, it's across the board, it's based on how cheap things can get. And as long as the only consideration is how cheap the chicken can get, then it's going to be very difficult to increase wages. The only real answer that's been shown to work is unions. I mean, as long as if workers don't have any sort of representation or way to bargain with managers about wages, they're not going to increase wages or give better benefits just because they're nice people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Santiago in Fort Worth. Hi, Santiago.
Hello. Hi. My question was if while he was working, you know, and just making friends, I guess you could say that, do you feel like threatened in any way? Were they friendly or... You know, how were they treating you while you were working with them?
I don't know if you were able to hear that. Santiago was asking about your coworkers and how they treated you.
I was pretty much across the board. I was very, I guess I was lucky in that everyone treated me with a lot of respect. And one of the things that surprised me about the year was, you know, I was working briefly in a lot of industries, and at jobs are very punishing and tiring, and how much sort of natural solidarity I found among workers in lettuce fields or poultry plants and people helping each other out. So, I mean, I was always an obvious outsider. In Arizona, I was an outsider because I'm white. In Russellville, Alabama, I was an outsider because I was from the north. But people really, you know, I never felt any sort of threatened by anything, or you know, the work is threatening just because it's tiring and exhausting, but my coworkers were all, you know, really helpful, and I learned a lot just from being able to hang around with them.
Well, we should say that you are fluent in Spanish. Would you have been able to get the same to have the same experience if you'd been in a place where there were, say, Asian immigrants and you did not speak the language?
No, and yes, that's a huge, I mean, that's a huge point to be made, is that it's not, you know, it's about, I was sort of exploring the work that immigrants do, but it's really, we're talking about Latino immigrants. And no, it wasn't, you would need to speak the language. In New York City, when I was doing food delivery on a bike, there's also immigrants from all over are doing that work, Asian, and I would sometimes, when I'm biking around dropping off food, try to strike up conversations with other delivery men, but you know, I don't speak Mandarin or Cantonese, so that really limited how much information or how much talking I could do with them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Carol in Mesquite. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Listening to this reminds me of Barbara Ehrenreich's book, Nickel and Dimed. Did you get your inspiration from her, or did you come up with this totally on your own?
Well, I was a big fan of that book too. Though, I mean, the direct inspiration was I had just finished a project, and I was reading the New York Times, trying to wondering what I wanted to do next, and read an article about this hog slaughtering plant in North Carolina, and how basically what the reporter described was that there had been a raid, and so to replenish the workforce, the company started to hire more aggressively among local U.S. citizens, and the turnover rate from the new hires was much higher, and people described about how the work was awful and swollen hands and just kind of nauseating. And I had read several other articles about raids in certain industries, leading to some labor shortages. So I figured that it might be a good chance for me to. There might be a good chance that I could get these jobs. But you know, like Ehrenreich, you know, I was less. What was most interesting to me was just how little I knew about this kind of work. And to have direct access. And once I realized I wanted to actually work the jobs, then it means, of course, then you can't tell bosses, then you have all this to figure out, like, a different story to tell them. I think it wasn't a direct influence at the time, but I'm sure reading Nickel and Dimed years ago has got me thinking about trying something similar with just maybe even on a subconscious level.
Gabriel, for your coworkers who did have their nuclear families here with them in the U.S., what sort of visions did they have for their children's futures?
College, mm-hmm. High school and college. You know, a lot of the Guatemalan coworkers, you know, had fled Guatemala during a civil war, and they were indigenous, so they were actually usually the people being persecuted. A number of them arrived in the U.S. not even speaking Spanish, so they learned Spanish in the fields of Florida, working with Mexicans. And many of them didn't even, you know, hadn't gone to grade school. So their kids, and it's really cool to be in Alabama and hear a 6-year-old person of Guatemalan descent speaking with a southern, heavy southern accent. But, yeah, I think the vision was definitely not come join me in the poultry plant. The vision was you have great access to school, and you're going to go to high school and then to college and continue onward.
You know, the concern is often raised that immigrants come to this country, some of them become naturalized and eventually become citizens. But I'm wondering, you know, people have said, but they don't engage all that much politically. It seems like with the level of exhaustion that they're facing at the end of the day, that this is a really sort of an additional burden to ask of them and yet a necessary one.
Yeah, and I think it will. It's more often the next generation.
Yeah.
That's, you know, it's people that are struggling in some of these most difficult jobs. You know, they may not have as much energy, but it'll be their children that do. But on the other hand, I should mention when, you know, I was in 2006, there were these huge marches all around the country in support of immigration reform, and in Russellville, I learned that actually one of the guys had gone to a nearby march and come back to Russellville and decided they wanted to hold their own march, and nothing like that had happened in town. And they decided they're going to hold it the next day. So they, in the course of a few hours, pulled it all together, and the next day there was like 500 people marching through downtown Russellville. which was something that town had never seen before, and I think was a real big, an eye-opening experience for people that suddenly, you know, wow, there's a huge immigrant community here. They're probably not going away, and we should probably start paying attention to them. So even though people were doing, you know, exhausting work, you do find ways in which they can become much more politically active than even a lot of, you know, normal U.S. citizens.
How did all this change the kinds of choices you make when you go to buy food?
Well, luckily I was a vegetarian before I entered the chicken plant for 20 years, so...
My guess is you would be after that, regardless.
Yeah, my appetite didn't get... I didn't suddenly have more interest in eating chicken. On a personal level, it's hard, you know, I was obsessed for a while with... I could not leave a grocery store without spending like 15 minutes in the produce aisle, lifting all the heads of lettuce and turning them over and admiring the cut. And it's interesting. I was just thinking about when you know, we all have this really deep connection to the work that immigrants do. When you reach and grab a head of lettuce, you know, often the last hand to touch that lettuce is the hand of the farm worker who cut it. But it's so, when you walk into a grocery store, it's hard to make that connection if you had a huge, you know, like a photo of one of the farm workers with their little story of who cut this lettuce. And, you know, it could cause you to pause a little more and think about it. But so a big part of how my thinking patterns have changed is I'm very often aware of, to an extent that I wasn't before, of how much work is going into all these things that benefit me that I wouldn't have made the connection otherwise.
What's the most effective thing we can do as consumers to try to make it possible for the ethical treatment of people who work in meat processing plants and agricultural fields?
Well, I think you have to, it's very hard to think about it on an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's on a larger scale, there is a growing movement, and you see it in like the popularity of a writer like Michael Pollan about food and looking at food as an issue and whether or not food is healthy for my children and how far away did it travel and did they use pesticides. I think one thing that would be very helpful in the future is people that are joined together in groups talking about food and safe food to also start turning their attention a little more to the workers that are in the middle of the food system. And that might mean, you know, we buy organic, but we also buy from companies that have committed to pay their workers a living wage. But that's to come.
The new book by journalist Gabriel Thompson is called Working in the Shadows, A Year of Doing the Jobs Most Americans Won't Do. Gabriel, fascinating work. Thank you so much for talking about it this hour.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.
This is your source for NPR News 90.1, KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth-Denton, and streaming online at kera.org. Also, 100.1 K261 CW Tyler. 88.3 K202 DR Wichita Falls. And 99.3 K257 EV Sherman. Stay tuned for more Think on your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1.
Boyd. Up next on Think, making the best choices at the end of life. Physician Jean Fitzpatrick has 30 years of experience working in small emergency rooms across the country, and her sister, attorney Eileen M. Fitzpatrick, has prepared advanced directives and living wills for clients in several states. They are committed to the idea that patients should be allowed to control what happens as they cope with terminal illness, including a natural but timely death when quality of life diminishes beyond the point they want to live. We'll talk to Dr. Fitzpatrick about what she calls the compassion protocol after the news from National Public Radio.